Yes, good morning and welcome to the Friday edition of Down to Brass Tacks. It's good to be with you this morning. I was having some difficulty hearing myself back, but it's perfect now. Good morning and welcome to the Friday edition of Down to Brass Tacks. Strange to hear me on a Friday. I'm happy to be here with you nonetheless. Of course, today is the 9th day of August 2019. And we are here with you until 1 p.m. Of course, the program ends at 1. This is the last day that we go until 1, and thereafter we will be going back to the traditional 2 o'clock ending hour. My name is Peter Wickham. Of course, I'm here with Michelle today. She has taken control of the board. This is a voice that you will hear. So you have the good fortune to hear a lady's voice when you call, as opposed to a male voice for a change. And I suspect that that, for most of you, will be a welcome change. The call number, 434-1790, of course. You can email me at peter.w.wickham@gmail.com. I want to get right into it, since we don't have a lot of time, and just say a couple of things. Let's start with a comment that appeared in the newspaper that was of some concern to me. It appears as though our Governor General supports corporal punishment. We have a tradition in the Westminster system where the head of state does not comment on matters that are either political or controversial. Suffice to say, I thought that that comment was unfortunate. I also thought it was unfortunate that the reporter who carried it did not understand the extent to which that type of thing is not consistent with what we do in the Westminster system. The Queen never comments on such matters, and certainly her representatives don't do either. Enough said. I want to say a few things about the constituency of St. Lucie. We started to speak about that last week. And the question of whether or not Ms. Verlo de Pisa, who is currently leading the Democratic Labour Party, should go to St. Lucie. I just wanted to give you my perspective on it. Now that we are out of the crop over season, we can get back to looking at matters political a bit from time to time. And just let me give you my perspective with regard to St. Lucie. And of course, I would have done some research on St. Lucie, and I want to acknowledge that, yes, the St. Lucie constituency does have a strong DLP tradition dating back to Arrow Barrow. I, however, want to point out that it does have some peculiarities. It was twice lost. The first one was in 1981, and it was a freak situation where there was a narrow loss on a 3.5% swing, while at the national level, the Democratic Labour Party was only on a 1.5% plus swing. So the DLP gained support. St. Lucie lost support to the extent of 3.5%. As I said, it was a freak situation. In 1981, when the DLP was gaining seats, they lost St. Lucie. That was one of the peculiar things about St. Lucie that makes me wonder whether it is a good fit for somebody who wants to be leader. Of course, the second loss is in 2018. It's significant that that loss was on a 20% swing, while the DLP was on a 25% swing. So suffice to say, the DLP did worse in Barbados than Mr. Dennis Kelman did in St. Lucie. So perhaps that is some good. The Democratic Labour Party has held the seat relatively consistently, notwithstanding those two issues. It withstood the BLP's 16.5% massive swing in 1999 with a 7.5, which was just as well, because the 16.5 there would have also put Mr. Dennis Kelman out of business. So certainly in 1999, it held on and held on well. That's the basis of the feeling that it is a good place for a potential leader, along with the fact that she apparently has a family history in St. Lucie. However, my concern with St. Lucie relates to its more recent history. Let's look at 2003. In 2003, the Democratic Labour Party gained 8.5% nationally, while in St. Lucie, it only gained 3.7% nationally. And at 57%, it was not a safe seat. So I am saying that from 2003, it was really not a safe seat. In the context of my own analysis, I have defined, based on the history of Barbados and so on, that a safe seat usually starts out at about 65-66% in terms of the kinds of swing that we normally see. So from 2003, effectively, St. Lucie was never really a safe seat. And as I said, the DLP gained 8.5% nationally, while St. Lucie only gained 3.7%, telling me that it underperformed in 2003. In 2008, The DLP gained 9.3, Kelman gained 4.8. Again, it underperformed and ended up with a 62% margin, which still was not a safe seat. And then we have the 2013 situation where Dennis Kelman had a minus 9.1% swing versus the Democratic Labor Party's minus 1.5% swing. So Dennis Kelman did worse in 2013 than the Democratic Labor Party did nationally. He ended up with 51%, which was one of the least safe seats in the Democratic Labor Party's arsenal, and it was therefore unsurprising that that went down with all the others in the last election. So is this instability related to Dennis Kelman, or is this instability related to the DLP generally? I have mixed views on that, and perhaps you may want to discuss that. Kelman clearly underperformed as a candidate. If you look at the electoral races that are quoted, clearly he was underperforming as a candidate. However, the reality of St. Lucie is also not consistent with that of a safe seat. If you look back 71 to 94, the average was 54%, which is not spectacular. The DLP's high point was in 1971 and 1986, where they got 59% and 57% respectively. Neither of those are safe seat numbers. The fact is that the seat was safe before 1971, and I'm seeing in 1971 a 71%, in 1966 a 70%, in 61 and 56 it was down to 61%. So it's clear to me that the problem was the shift to single-member constituencies in 1971, which effectively reduced the DLP's strength and moved it from a safe to a marginal seat. So what I'm suggesting to you is that if you look 71 beyond, St. Lucie is anything but safe. If you look before 71, safety seemed to have been related to the fact that we had this double member constituency in those situations. This has continued with 30% of the support and a whopping 20% swing needed to recapture the seat in the current scenario. So in the current scenario where the DLP holds 30 seats, 30%, you need a massive 20% swing in order to recapture it, which is a daunting prospect. And in my opinion, it is not something that is likely to be achieved. No, I accept that when the time comes, you need to do a poll on the ground and see what people are saying. But I'm saying that in terms of our history, in terms of the regularity of electoral swings and shifts and movements, the likelihood of St. Lucie changing hands and going back to the Democratic Labor Party, in my opinion, is really quite low. And certainly, if a leader wants to lead, the first thing that that person has to do is to secure themselves politically, because you can't be leading in a situation where you're fighting for your own political survival. So that is the basis of my view on the matter, and I do hope that you will call and share your opinions on that and other matters as we proceed with the program. Remember, the call number is 434-1790. I have as my first caller this morning Miss Marcia Hines Lane. Are you there, Marcia?
Yes, I am. Greetings, Peter.
Greetings, ma'am, and welcome to the program. I always look forward to the opportunity to chat with you on matters relating to gender, especially, but on all other matters. Initially, Marcia, when we spoke about a week ago and I asked you if you could come and join me this morning as the first caller, I want to discuss with you my reservations about your reaction to the recent incident and also the reaction of Cammie Holder to the recent incident. But I think that we have agreed between ourselves that we won't go into that. I don't know if you want to just give your basic position now regarding commenting on that matter.
Well, no, I'm not going to do that, because I think there was a very clear statement, and it was purported to have belonged to the mother who is at the center of this tragic loss, asking for her privacy to grieve at this time, and I respect that. Mm-hmm. And so out of that concern, you know, people who have said to me, well, what was the rationale, what was the motive, I have said to them, much like how I've explained it to you this morning, what was the rationale and motive. But I'm, you know, out of respect for her request to be able to have some space to breathe, it is not something that I'm going to go into in this forum. Like you, if there are any other people who, you know, want to hear my perspective, I would be more than happy to have a quiet conversation that doesn't cause, you know, her to feel like she's on blast in a public space.
Okay. All right. Marcia, at a broader level, I often get the impression that there is this ongoing battle between yourself representing the National Organization of Women, and certainly Cami Holder and others representing either MISA or just representing men generally, that there's this tug of war between men and women regarding children, regarding custody, and the perception that men are treated badly in these matters. I mean, in a general sense, what is your feeling in relation to this, and what do you think that we can do to help deal with these perceptions?
All right. Well, that is a great place to start, Peter. Thanks for the opportunity to start right there. Now, first of all, I believe that the call to advocacy, the call to activism, is something that starts from a personal place. There are many activists across the world stage who have started their particular movements and started their particular agitations based on personal experience. That in itself is not a strange thing. What is strange, though, is when an individual continues to simply use the activist or activism advocacy space to push a personal agenda. Because by the time you now become, quote unquote, the voice and face of a movement, the voice and face of a principle, it can no longer be a personal matter. And I will always have a difficulty with anybody who purports to be an activist or an advocate and is speaking in the name of individuals who is simply using the space seemingly to continue a personal vendetta. You know, the training in the space, the responsibility in the space calls for something higher than that. So let me start there. Mm-hmm. Now, the second thing is, although we want to have better relations between the genders, in this case, male and female, with respect to families and with respect to raising children, we have to understand that from the time you're making a call for equality for women, you're talking about a political movement. And once you're talking about a political movement, you're talking about power, and you're talking about the redistribution of power. And I do not know anywhere in any space where power is simply relented and redistributed. So at the crux of the movement for equality for women's lives and women's experiences, you are going to have somewhat of a political struggle. So that is the next reality. Outside of that, though, there is room for conversation between the various actors in the space. And I do not feel in any way like MESA and NOW are at any war. There are conversations that are had between MESA and NOW. I think the president of MESA himself would have made that clear in his response in the last couple of days. So there is conversation, but at the end of the day, there are also going to be issues when we are going to stand on our principle and he's going to stand on his principle. And that is not necessarily to be perceived as a war, as much as it should be perceived as the redistribution of power. That's exactly what we are doing in this gender space.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that sounds entirely reasonable. I made a comment last week about the fact that MESA and NOW aren't evenly yoked. You know that they are. I am a fan of NOW and NOW's capacity for activism. The national organization is an umbrella organization that includes how many organizations?
It includes, we have at least 20 active organizations under the umbrella of NOW. Okay. MESA really is the equivalent of one of the of the groups under NOW. Mm-hmm. NOW is an umbrella of active organizations spanning across a wide demographic in Barbados. MESA is not the same thing.
Right. And that's a point that has to be made, you know.
Yeah, people expect us to negotiate in the space in the same way. And I think that is, frankly, the patriarchy at work.
Yeah. But the other point is that, you know, National Organization of Women runs, you run a shelter and you run several other active programs. I'm at a loss as to what MESA does on an ongoing basis that is, you know, institutionalized beyond the activism which we hear of. So I think that's an important point that has to be made. Sure, go ahead.
Let me just slightly correct something there, because I don't want anybody, you know, people are very jealous of their spaces in activism and advocacy. The Barbados Professional Women's Club, which is one of the affiliate clubs under the National Organization of Women, runs a shelter for battered women.
My apologies.
So it's not strictly, that's fine. But the distinction definitely has to be made.
Yeah.
Now, the other thing that I would say is that MESA has some young and progressive minds who are now being attracted to this space. And those younger and more progressive minds are doing some of the work in terms of, for example, mentorship and educating other men, you know, who find themselves in various situations before the law court and that kind of thing. You know, they are doing more of that work. And I will say that that is happening because it is happening. But outside of that, I'm going to leave the rest of your comment to go down line. Because I really don't want to comment.
Let me just get you in quickly because we need to wrap this up so that we can get to the calls. Your view on the Calypso offering this year. We had a conversation in which you and I disagreed. We disagree a lot, but I think that it's all in good spirit.
It's healthy.
Yeah.
It's healthy,
earlier this year regarding this Hooking Me Calypso, which I absolutely love, and I think it is reflective of a reality. You had some reservations about it. Have any of those concerns regarding the tone of the Calypsos translated to your experience this year in the crop over? Do you think that any of them were particularly hard on women or unfairly so regarding the genders? And what was your general perspective overall?
Well, again, when you come to the space of activism, there's a responsibility. So I found myself actually sitting out crop over festival this year because I was conflicted on a philosophical level about some of the messages that I was hearing in the Calypso. That is not to say that I don't still love Calypso. That is not to say that the music wasn't sweet, sweet, sweet. It was all of that. Mm-hmm. But it was also problematic.
But tell us specifically.
If you're going to go into a set and you don't know what woman's face look like because she always been over, it says to me that you haven't negotiated consent, because unless you've bent over first to ask the woman, hey, do you want me to wind up on this bam bam that is bent over? You have not negotiated consent.
But Marsha.
Yes.
Marsha. You see, this girl, you and I is getting all the time, you know. Marsha, listen, if this is a lady, right, who all you see is the boxy, right?
Uh-huh.
Clearly, there's a negotiated consent because the boxy there for anybody that won't pass and wind on it. But maybe that's the case.
As a feminist in training, I'm very surprised.
But Marsha, my thing is, if a lady does not present the bottom for that, for whining.
But I have presented
that's fine.
The bottom to whine.
But if you present it to whine and you ain't looking back to see who whining, but was it? Clearly, the consent is open.
No, it is not open.
Because an open invitation for a whine is not an open invitation for anything else.
But there is not even such a thing as an open invitation to whine. I might be whining because I went in the gym all year. I spend my money, my bams look good, and I want to wind up my bams. It has nothing to do with you.
Suppose you are the type of woman, or you are a woman of inclined to say, I don't care what you look like. I want a man to whine behind me. And if you are that man, come on, whine, full stop. I ain't looking back because it's not important. Because it's nothing more than a casual whine. Keeping it simple,
Why can't we have a verse at least then that speaks to that reality?
Whoa.
You see, this is why I'm not going to come out and fight, because I understand that the views are not popular. But they're the things that remain that make me conflicted, right?
But that's,
if we realize that men and women have power, and women also have that power, there was sing a little line that says, and I saw that there was a woman actually at a presentation where he sang the song, that actually made that point. She made it so eloquently, because at the end of the day, women also have power. But why do we miss that in the music?
You see, my thing is that if a woman wants consent to be sought before someone weighs on her, it's reasonable. I think it's acceptable that we have to get out of this idea that a bamsi is there to whine on, just because it is there.
Problematic.
If, however, a bamsi presents itself for whining with nothing further, then I don't really see the problem either. I am not saying necessarily that you or anyone else is the type of woman that I suspect that you would prefer consent to be sought before whining begins. If, however,
it's not a preference, it's a right.
Right, but that's fine. And I'm saying that's but that's you, that's Marsha. I'm saying if there is another woman who does not particularly care about consent, so she issues a general consent by presenting the bamsi.
Because she doesn't care about consent doesn't mean she still doesn't have a right to it.
But I am not saying she don't have a right. But if she's saying, I have given up that right temporarily in the context of that party.
She hasn't said that by just bending over the bamsi, Peter. And this is why the music is problematic, because it feeds into the cultural misconceptions.
Marsha, I don't know, boy. What about the other one now, the Sometimes song?
Again, if you guys want to accept that that is a reality in Barbados and we are very much a sometime culture, then you can't be hypocritical about it. If there is a sometime arrangement, sometimes they're going to end up with a pregnancy that then has to be negotiated. So if the woman in a sometime relationship and a sometime child come along and she don't want an all-the-time child, why are abortions in Barbados still so hard to get?
Yeah, but you see, that was the comment that sparked this off in the first place where I said that you and I need to talk. Because in the context of the Caribbean society, Barbados is one of the easiest places to get an abortion. I have to admit that the cost is prohibitive. But of course it is, Marsha. You could get an abortion on request in Barbados.
Very quickly, let me explain.
You can go and get the morning after pill. I see women walking to pharmacies. I go and whisper. As you see them whispering to the pharmacist, you don't know what they're coming for.
Let me explain something quickly to you, Peter.
You don't need a prescription?
Practice in this case and law are not the same thing. There is a legal process in Barbados which governs abortion, okay? And that legal process doesn't make it quite as accessible as you think it does. There are a lot of attending issues.
For example,
there are not legal abortions in Barbados can only be done at the Queen Elizabeth Hospital. There is supposed to be a set of counseling. There's supposed to be a set of mechanisms.
No, but early term abortions can be done at Family Planet. It's late term abortions that can only be done at the QEH, but early terms can be done at Family Planet. And they have done several.
Peter, what I'm saying to you is, when you see women then who go into pharmacies or who go to private doctors to seek abortions, those women, as far as I know, are not quite operating within what should happen. And we are saying the same thing. There is no reason why they shouldn't be operating within what should happen. Free up the abortion.
But Marsha, which Caribbean country has a more liberal atmosphere than Barbados?
Barbados
out front. Marsha, Barbados is out front legislatively. No, and I will, Marsha, you and I could go toe to toe on this. I know that Barbados has issues because I believe that Barbados needs to get to the stage where women can have abortions performed at no cost to themselves. I think that that is an area that we need to work on. But in terms of the legislative environment, I mean, and I've looked at the different postures, Barbados has almost choice.
I'm not talking necessarily here about the legislative stance. I'm talking about the experience and the practice, which is very different.
Right.
There are places where you can go in Barbados and you can get an abortion performed, yes, outside of Queen Elizabeth Hospital. I'm not going to speak to the Family Planning because that one is one that I have to do research on, and I'm going to ask them. But if we agree that we are progressive and that we have since 1980-something said that In the legislative form, we want abortions to be, you know, accessible. Then why don't we just regularize it across the board? Everybody don't want sometime baby. That's the reality.
No difficulty, because it's a reality. The reality is if you can have casual sex, you can't have casual children.
That's the point.
I have heard any number of stories of people who I know that say that when, you know, the woman get pregnant, they're like, but it's not that kind of relationship.
Right, and but then those are the ones that cause the most problems.
There you go.
Know that, right?
So, I think that to some extent, our legislation has kept pace with our social attitudes. And as I said, since the 1980s, Barbados was out front regarding the medical termination of pregnancy. There's no other country in the Caribbean that has been more progressive than we have.
Like I said,
and then there are several less progressive, like Jamaica, like Trinidad and Tobago, that are still in the dark ages.
It is, like I said, not necessarily what is in the legislation, but the practice and the cultural norms that then make a woman presenting to have that same abortion done faced with a whole set of behaviors and views that don't necessarily make the space comfortable. But like I keep saying, Peter, if we understand that women are negotiating medical abortions, are negotiating abortions in private clinics, et cetera, let us streamline the practices. Right. I don't have a problem with a sometimes society if we know that that is what we have and that we cannot be hypocritical in the having of it. That's all.
All right, Marcia, unfortunately, we are on 28 minutes past 10, and no Michelle is actually gesturing that she's going to break my neck shortly. So I think thanks a lot for chatting with me, Marcia. Appreciate it very much. We take a break and come right back with more of Down to Brass Tacks.
Welcome
back to Down to Brass Tacks, 434-1790. Good morning.
Hello, hi. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning, sir. How are you doing?
Not too bad at all. Listen, I just want to make a comment.
Sure.
On what your Marsha was discussing, but I don't want you to engage me. I want to get into my politics.
All right.
And because you're ducking around last thing, right? Mm-hmm. You're ducking around Tuesday, so let me make this little comment. The Tiger War that you speak about is not between Mesa and now. The Tiger War is fair judgment between men and the court system in Barbados. Okay? Mm-hmm. Okay. That is where the Tiger War is. Like you said, that's just a comment I'm making. Okay?
As much as I want to comment, I won't. You carry on, sir.
Good. Now, last time when we had we little Calypso rendezvous, I told you that I want to speak a little politics. And you tell me, okay, keep that one for free.
Yeah.
Good. Now, I'm happy to be here. And I'm happy to speak to you one more time. Peter, some comments. And I am not defending in this comment now or my presentation. I'm not defending the Democratic Labour Party. The Democratic Labour Party can do their own defending for themselves. And what people have to realize, the Democratic Labour Party, their party is almost 60 years old, you know. It's an institution. It's a very strong institution in Barbados. So they got the art, they know the science, and they know how to win. They come back from defeat twice already, and they bounce back.
Right.
I have no doubt that they will bounce back again. But this is something that you're missing. This is something that you're missing, even in your presentation this morning, about in your preamble, about St. Lucie and Verla. You would notice in modern politics, and when it's a modern politics in St. Lucie, I'm not speaking about the double member constituency. I'm speaking about single member.
71 onward.
Good. The Democratic Labour Party and St. Lucie, as a matter of fact, St. Lucie is very good real estate for the Democratic Labour Party. It always has been.
Do you listen to anything I said this morning?
Of course, and I want.
But how can you hear? How can you hear that presentation and still be convinced that it's good real estate? Good real estate is a 65% level of support. The Democratic Labour Party has enjoyed that twice in St. Lucie, and that was always before 1971.
I am saying to you, Peter. I am saying to you, from 71,
right?
The Democratic Labour Party enjoy the greatest portion of the pie in St. Lucie, the Democratic Labour Party. As far as I know, you had a guy called Roy Braffett and now Peter Phillips. Okay? Over 40 years, buddy. So what are you saying to me that is not good real estate?
I am saying to you that good real estate is a seat that I can win. So you would send a leader up there.
This is another thing that you're missing, Peter. There's nobody that I honestly can remember that is not of St. Lucie, whether B or D, that ever takes St. Lucie. And if you're telling me, if you're saying to me that Verla de Pisa roots and neighbor string is buried in St. Lucie, like Kelman, like
Evening Graves?
Graves and those guys. And Roy Braffett, and the present guy.
Cammy was from out there too.
And Kelly.
Cammy.
Who? Cammy Tudor?
Cammy Tudor.
Yes. He's St. Lucie.
He's a St. Lucie man too. Okay.
Right. So all I'm saying to you, big man, right? That nobody out of St. Lucie, right? Sorry, everybody that ran in St. Lucie, that is from St. Lucie.
All the representatives have been from St. Lucie. The problem that you have is that the current representative is also from St. Lucie.